These violent delights of violent ends.
Welcome to Violent Delights, a Westworld podcast. We are your hosts, Andrew Cersini,
Dwayne DeFreitas,
and Tosin Anafawakin.
We just watched the third episode of HBO's Westworld titled The Stray. We assume you have as well. Total spoilers ahead. So let's dive into the after talk. But first of all, some social links for you. You can write to us or email us a voice memo at hbowestworldpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at hbowestworldpod or just hashtag violentdelights. And our Facebook page is at Westworld Podcast. You can add us on iTunes, and if you do so, please like us and leave a review because it helps more people find the show. All right, so The Stray. Dwayne, would you mind giving us a recap?
Sure. The Stray is episode 3, and it lays out deeper tensions in the plot, where episode 2 kind of established the intrigue in the plot. We have host malfunctions that are still present. The Madame Maeve remembers the room where she saw all the dead hosts, and she gets triggers when she looks at Teddy in the face. She recognizes him from that experience she had in episode 2. We get our first inkling of a stray, that things happen normally strangely in the Westworld space. And Stubbs, the security guy, and Elsie, the coder in training under Bernard, go out to pick it up, and they end up in some trouble. We gain insight into a possible root of the malfunctions that we've been seeing, and we learn about a person named Arnold. Dolores breaks from her narrative, and she shoots Rebus, the kind of gunslinger man in black, not quite the man in black, but the gunslinger host that's always chasing her down. And we still wonder how she got the gun that she found in the dirt. But we know that she can shoot it, despite the fact that apparently she doesn't have privileges to shoot a normal gun. So there's something special about it. Walter's last moments are examined. Walter was the guy, if you remember, he was the host that had gotten shot. He was drinking milk and it was flowing out of his body, but he was still standing around and people were just very scared. We learned that he killed 6 of 9 hosts that were around in the saloon. He let 3 of them go away. Of the 9 go away, but the 6 he killed were hosts that killed him and other storylines.
Right.
So that's kind of like what's going on with the main plot. The hosts are getting wacky. They're still creaky. We're not really sure what's going on. In the subplots, we meet a new female that Rebus refers to as a dickless associate of Teddy. She wields a rifle, and she seems pretty interested in adventure. She doesn't have the same kind of cognitive dissonance that William, the new guest played by Jimmy Simpson, is suffering. Right. Although he does experience his first steps into Westworld when he shoots a bandit to save a prostitute host and then decides to join a posse to find other bandits. Logan, his sort of hedonistic friend who's been there a bunch of times, he tags along. And later on in the episode, they actually encounter Dolores, who's escaped from her rape narrative that she's always in. Mm-hmm. So there's some interesting stuff going on there. We don't see, speaking of Dolores, we don't see her counterpart, the man in black, this episode. We just see a flashback where he's like, let's get to know one another better, sort of right before we assume a rape scene happens. And then there's all this stuff kind of going on with Bernard, right? Bernard has secret conversations with Dolores, proving he's using her as some sort of test subject to better understand the emerging consciousness of the hosts, perhaps. He presents her with a book about change, including Alice in Wonderland. And it's clear that she's visually modeled off of Alice in Wonderland. Bernard's affair with Cullen, as we anticipated last episode, creates that tension between the needs of the board and corporate and what's going on in actual Westworld. Mm-hmm. She's pressuring him for not anticipating a disruption to the park caused by Ford's new plot line, his new narrative. And she approaches him sort of with no caring. She's like, where have you been? I got a late start. She jumps on him and says, effectively, I don't care about your sleeping patterns. We got stuff to do. Now, getting back to Ford, his new narrative plotline is being built into the host. And we see how that happens, which is nice, because in a lot of things, you just kind of like, oh, it happens. They show us how it happens. Things get uploaded. Conversations occur, that sort of thing. Rather than call on new units, as Sizemore had, he intends to expand on the histories of existing units, like Teddy, who had a nebulous backstory that he intends to flesh in. Sizemore isn't present at all. And that's kind of where we are. At the end of the episode again, you know, we've got the situation where Dolores, who's been kind of this damsel in distress the whole time, takes agency. And she, you know, just like she killed a fly to protect herself in the first episode, she has this gun. She manages to hide it in the hay. She takes out Rebus, and she runs and eventually lands in the arms of our sort of new, I guess, hero, William, who's played by Jimmy Simpson.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting that she's stepping up, right? Moves from the fly to killing another host. You can kind of see that arc as she's escalating.
She is like the Khaleesi. She is like the Dany Targaryen of this paradigm, the Westworld paradigm, or the Peggy from Mad Men, if you will. It's the
she goes from being the victim to being someone with true agency. Yeah.
Yes.
We haven't seen a lot of that yet. I mean, she did still fall in someone's arms, fainting, and right. We know that like normally she can't just pick up a gun and shoot. So she's got a long way to go, but that track, the trend line does seem clear that she might be going that way, especially because of all these sort of scenes we see in the future where she's like riding a horse and shooting a gun and stuff.
I'm going to start with you, Dwayne. What were your salient points about this episode? What did you like about this?
I think my favorite thing was from a narrative, from the story's narrative perspective. I like the way that we're seeing time being used in the show. In the beginning, we kind of realized there's kind of a Groundhog Day going on with these narrative loops that they've got going.
I love that, by the way. I mentioned it on the last, on the first recap that we did, but I need to mention it again, is I love the whole repetition thing, because it really does, once you're familiar with the repetition, you really, it makes those changes in that repetition so much more significant.
Right. So for me, and I think for a lot of viewers, because of the repetition, because of the way it's designed in terms of they've got these narrative loops, those changes do matter. But more important than that, they give us a concrete understanding of how this world works, as opposed to you've just got robots running around this like fake park, and maybe that works, maybe it doesn't. We know that it's very regimented, it's very tight. And what I like about the way time is used is that toward the end of the episode, the climax, you have this wonderful scenario where, you know, Dolores, let's go back to the beginning. You know, she's got this gun, it's wrapped in a shawl. Then suddenly she doesn't have the gun, so it's no longer wrapped in the shawl, but she puts the shawl away. Later on, we find that the gun, whether she put it there or some other way it got there, it was in the hay. She's now remembering, because of the Bernard conversations and because Bernard refuses to erase her logs, that she knows what's going to happen, or she has an inkling as to what's going to happen. And so she's now prepared. So it's hard for her, it seems, to take out Rebus, this kind of like bandit guy.
But played by Trevor from GTA 5, by the way. Stephen Ogg is the actor.
Exactly. That's a really interesting thing, because recently there was like GTA 5 video. But anyway, she shoots him. And then, you know, she runs out and she tries to kind of engage the other guy on the porch, and she gets shot. And then instantly what the director has done is he tracks forward in time a complete day to when this happens again.
Yeah.
So we know Rebus is dead and she's out there, and she remembers that she got shot. So she just jumps on her horse and runs away. And for me, the movement through time in that way, expressing that she figured it out and she learned from that instance, it ties to two things: time and memory, which we know the Nolan brothers like, between like, you know, what happened in Inception and what happened in Memento. But here we've got Dolores, who's using the fact that she has access to memory, which we take for granted, and the plot, which is saying we don't have time to kind of show you all this stuff over and over again. You'll get bored. So we're just going to pop this in there, let you realize that, you know, she's going in baby steps. She takes out Rebus, she gets out, she dies. She takes out Rebus, she gets out, she runs away. It's very much like a video game, which is a theme that we've been seeing again and again, with the man in black looking for, trying to figure out the puzzle.
With the show in general.
The show
in general is informed by video game play, by modern video game play. We've heard that from the showrunners, and we see it in practice in the way the shows are laid out.
Yeah, that's very profound that you say that, because even when we were discussing in the earlier episode about, you know, choosing when you're entering into these virtual worlds, choosing how you want your character to be. Is it the white hat? Is it the black hat? Are you the hero, or are you going to be more like the villain? Sort of like the Fable-esque fable-esque journey that each of these individuals mm-hmm. take throughout the script. And once they're in the world, right, once we have the humans interacting with the hosts, as we've seen throughout time, it's a different world that they're in, meaning that, you know, the things they do, the decisions they make have no consequence mm-hmm. out in the real mm-hmm. world.
Right. I mean, it's I think the video game thing does matter, that's where you get that kind of, you know, all this crazy behavior and everything. But what I also like about it is that, you know, again, she's leveling up through the video games.
Yeah.
Which is fitting, because we have this narrative, this Alice in Wonderland narrative, right? And Alice in Wonderland, as we know, is a coming of age story. Where age for this ageless robot is actually consciousness, or something that looks like consciousness.
Evolution.
Right. She's evolving with every passing night that she has to go through this terrible scenario. And that's I thought that was pretty cool. So the way the time works.
And by the way,
allows us to move forward.
I just want to say that I didn't get that at first. So I'm glad that you got it and understood that was what was going on, because I didn't quite get why we were seeing. I knew we were seeing glimpses of past loops, but I didn't get that it was chronological, you know, that it was like the next day and the next day and the next day.
Right. Or it may not be directly the next day, but it's certainly the next time that scenario presents itself, assuming that there was no kind of hiccup in the loop. You know, she didn't go off with some dude on a horse somewhere or whatever.
Sure.
Speaking of Alice in Wonderland, that's the salient part that really stuck with me throughout this episode. So visually, Dolores really conveys herself as Alice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think you can tell that she's really eager to escape this vicious cycle and escape this sort of world. And Teddy tells her someday we'll be able to escape, but she knows this is sort of a false promise, mm-hmm. which is why she wants it now. There was a really salient quote that was used. Andy, do you want to tell our listeners what that was?
When Bernard's got her in the secret interrogation, he gives her a book that he used to read to his kid, which is important in his backstory. But it's Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. And the quote that she has her read is, "Dear, dear, how clear is everything today? And yesterday things went on just as usual. I wonder if I've been changed in the night. Let me think. Was I the same when I got up this morning? I almost think I can remember feeling a little different. But if I'm not the same, the next question is, who in the world am I?" Which is incredibly relevant to what's going on in
Dolores. It's the anchor of the entire episode where Dolores is concerned.
Yeah.
I think that's a big thing. And I just love the fact that it's this, you know, it's from chapter 2, Alice in Wonderland. We've seen her as she is this whole time. And it's only when he hands her that Alice in Wonderland book, do you realize that the director, the wardrobe, directorial staff, whoever, has made this blonde woman in a blue dress. She's been Alice the whole time, and they revealed it to us. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you know, I didn't jump there. We've been talking about this thing for weeks. I never thought, oh, she's Alice in Wonderland. But the minute you see that, you get it. This is not something that they did willy-nilly.
Yeah.
This has been planned. And Alice in Wonderland, I think, Andy, you can speak to it. It's easy to kind of screw that up, right? It's easy to just kind of call someone Alice in Wonderland and kind of like make that super lazy writing. But I think here there's more gravitas to it because they actually set her up as this. And then they said, "Hey guys, in case you didn't notice, wink, wink." And I thought that was pretty powerful.
But I have to say here that I feel like whenever I hear an allusion to Alice in Wonderland or The Wizard of Oz is another example in modern writing, it's a trigger for me because I feel like it's really low hanging fruit for a screenwriter to fall back on those comparisons, those allegorical comparisons, and I'm hoping that this is kind of the extent of the Alice in Wonderland comparisons, and we don't have like an analog for every character in Alice in Wonderland within our show. You know, I hope that, you know, Ford isn't the White Rabbit, because then it does feel a little bit like lazy writing to me.
I thought you were going to say it's a trigger for the Alice Through the Looking Glass and sequel and Alice in Wonderland films, which were not the greatest.
Right. But you know what's interesting about Through the Looking Glass? Remember in episode 2 when Maeve looks at her reflection, she sees the past. And when our Alice here, Dolores, looks at her reflection. She ends up in a reflection in that room.
We definitely
for the first time with Ford.
Right.
So there is this imagery does still mm-hmm. sit here, right? Mm-hmm. This idea of like through the looking glass, you're going to be in an alternate world, right? That's through the looking glass. And then Alice, these adventures again. Bernard yeah. is working with her to get to this place, and it's not just that Alice in Wonderland is the book he's reading with her. It seems that every single book he rolls with her is a book that has the theme of change. And even the robot recognizes the theme has been change. She can carry along. She can track yeah. that. So we're looking at a situation where this Alice thing, you know, it's pretty tied up in the idea of her personal growth, which right. is interesting because it's very concrete. First section, abstract reference. They're not trying to, again, like you said, Andy, you know, Ford isn't going to be the Mad Hatter with, you know, Bernard being there, the rabbit or whatever. In fact, it's just kind of focused on Dolores, who she is as a person, and a way to explain her growth and how it happens incrementally over time, which I think is pretty powerful.
So,
and not bang you over the heady.
Right.
And the last thing I'd say about Alice is that we've got this place where in the beginning of the episode, Bernard has a discussion with her, and you know, he talks to her and he says something like, "Hey, why did you ask me about my son?" And she kind of comes back with this rote response, "Well, my programming says I need to ask you about yourself." Later on, she says something really interesting in response to all this reading she's been doing, that when I discover who I am, I'll be free. And then Bernard asks, "What prompted that response?"
Mm-hmm.
And he expects, you know, maybe some programming or something. And she comes back and she says, "I don't know." And that's another sign that she's moving past her original coding, her original parameters.
Right.
And that's what he's getting out of her. He also expresses that maybe this is too much. He says he's perhaps been selfish, that he should maybe restore her. And he even goes so far as to say, which version of yourself do you like better? And from her perspective, there's only one version. And that's how yeah. she gets the idea that when she knows herself, she will be free, which has got a whole bunch of like Taoist stuff in there and everything too.
It's
hard to unpack. But yeah, I mean, it's pretty crazy how Bernard has done this. And again, you know, Bernard is treating her pretty differently than other hosts, and we just don't know why.
Yeah.
He loosens the
chains on her so that she gives more realistic responses rather than
right.
the phrases that they've tied in.
Right. Do you get that this is the end game for Bernard is to cultivate a sense of sentience from her?
I think to a certain extent it is, but also it sort of seems like Bernard kind of wants to fill this gap that was there from his son.
Right.
It seems like he's sort of treating her as kind of his new child that he needs to take care of and that he wants to be able to grow. He wants her to be more than a host and to actually be human, I think. That's what at least that's how I felt.
We get a little bit of that from the teleconference he has with his, I don't know if it's his wife or his ex-wife, the Gina Torres character.
Yeah, and you kind of are seeing a contrast between him and Ford and sort of how Ford is seeing the hosts and what Ford warns him about.
Yeah, you know, when I look at the way he interacts with her, with Dolores, to go back to Andy's point, is he trying to cultivate sentience? I feel like it's really unclear. On the one hand, my intuition tells me that he was using her as a way to determine what was going wrong with the hosts, right? Like, he's like, "Hey, Cullen, we got this. We fixed it." And Cullen knows. She straight up says, "Look, I know you haven't fixed the problem because you keep on pulling these guys off and testing them out. Like, what's going on here?" And he avoids answering that question. When it comes to what's going on with Dolores, it's almost as if he's like, "Well, I'm not really sure what the reverie situation, what's happened there. And there's something I don't understand here." And you know, Elsie is the same way. It's something that we don't know here. We need to do something
right.
here. And so what you see here is Bernard kind of trying to, on one level, it seems like he's trying to use her to figure out what's gone wrong, or
mm-hmm.
maybe even dabble in the consciousness perspective. But he's having doubts. He's having kind of innovator's dilemma. He's sitting there
right.
and he's saying, "Should I push this forward? Am I being selfish or am I trying to figure it out? I think I'm being selfish. I'm not sure." Then he goes and asks the subject of his experiment, and she's not equipped to give him that answer. So there's a lot going on there that we still don't know about. But I think you're right. He is playing with sentience, but he's not quite sure what he wants to do with sentience. Whereas, I think Tosin was leading to, you know, Ford is not interested in sentience, right? I mean, we can talk about Arnold.
We'll right.
get into that.
Let's talk a little bit about that now. Now that you bring it up, so let's talk about Ford and the information that he gives to Bernard, which is basically the backstory, who this Arnold character is. Arnold is the co-founder of Westworld, who was erased from history when he basically took his experiments a little too far. And it was it seemed to be clear that
he ended up dead.
And ended up dead, and we don't know exactly the logistics of how he died. We just know that somehow through his chasing down consciousness, it consumed him to his death. In that scene, Ford lays out this sort of pyramid of how Arnold was instilling consciousness in the hosts through memory, improvisation, and self-interest. And then,
right.
And
we should say that this is sort of this idea of the bicameral mind.
Right.
The idea that it's a very controversial idea from the 1970s that said that up until 3,000 years ago, humans effectively thought that any thought they had in their head was the voice of God or some deity. And so they acted relatively nuts and couldn't organize into civilization because they were kind of acting out what they thought were God fantasies. And then suddenly, magically, between the Iliad and the Odyssey, humanity effectively figured out the difference between, you know, inner monologue and like a deity talking to you, and then we got organized. It's a very controversial concept of the idea of Christ in the mind or God in the mind that's been pretty much debunked, but it is from 30 or 40 years ago, which is when we know Westworld began. So the idea that this Arnold guy could have been using that as a model to I think the phrase they use is bootstrap sentience, is a nice tie-in to our actual world and how science changes over time, how thinking changes over time. So in that, you get this pyramid that Andy was talking about. I want to take you back to your period.
He laid out this pyramid with the this route towards what we believe would have been sentience using the bicameral mind, which is just a fascinating concept to introduce into this whole storyline. The whole thing about Arnold having the hosts believe that their directives are coming from an inner voice, from a voice of God. Now, we've already seen that from the beginning of the show, from the first episode, we hear those voices, you know, and it's a common theme. And Ford says that the last vestiges of this bicameral mind concept are in the tech commands, the tech voice commands that they give to the hosts.
Which is a boon for me, because I look at that and I think, jackpot, right? Like, we now know what's really going on, perhaps in a magical way. Like,
right.
When I look at that, I see, you know, we saw Abernathy, that is Dolores' father.
In a flashback.
In a flashback. He had a flashback. And that flashback, because of the Reverie software, made him say these violent delights have violent ends.
Yeah,
right.
We saw Abernathy as the professor that was mentioned in the first episode at the end of the original.
Exactly. So we know that there are voice commands, right? Voice commands are used all over the place. We now know that Arnold was the architect of these voice commands, and Arnold is dead.
Yeah.
We also know that Ford wasn't really. He doesn't give a lot of credence to Arnold's work, although he does like the voice command situation, clearly. Mm-hmm. We also know that, you know, if Arnold was working independently and they weren't really getting along, then Ford may not know all of the voice commands. Now, the idea that this violent delights lead to violent ends thing kind of transmits from Dolores' father to Dolores to Maeve, the prostitute. Every time one of them hears it, it triggers this sort of independence that is kind of the heart of these issues that the robots have been having, the hosts have been having.
Yeah.
And so it seems that there is this kind of this interesting connection where Ford may not know that these violent delights lead to violent ends is indeed a command that can break open, create these cognitive problems that these robots have. So, I mean, this is all based on just me looking at the text itself. It's less of a you know, it's looking directly at what we see in the show as opposed to kind of coming up from willy-nilly. But I do think that there is a connection there between the fact that you've got this robot who got access to his old memories through reveries, and that's how he got the Violent Delights command. He said it, he opened up, he told his daughter she opened up. So you get this thing where Ford breaking into the reveries has released something that Arnold had put in there the whole time. And that makes a good recipe for the kind of trouble that we see.
Maybe that's really why Ford is also shaming these, like shaming the coworker for kind of giving the host coverage and making sure people know that these are not living, breathing humans. These are hosts. These, you know, they should be treated as such. Maybe that's why we see it.
There's also some culture stuff going on in Westworld, right? Like you said, that Ford yells at that guy or just basically dresses him down.
He shames the tech for anthropomorphizing the hosts and not remembering that they're not real.
It's like he shames the tech for thinking that the host has any kind of shame. But what's really interesting to me is that, you know, he shames the tech and he gives Bernard a pretty hard time about Bernard's probing, right? He like finally says, okay, fine, I'll tell you about Arnold. If there shouldn't be any problems, if there's a problem, let me know. But really, you can deal with this. Meanwhile, Bernard is doing the same thing with Elsie. Elsie's like, I want to take Dolores off the floor. Look at this footage of Walter screaming about Arnold and shooting people and having this stuff. So Bernard's response to that isn't, oh, my God, you figured it out. Bernard's response is, why don't you go chase that stray? So there's like this kind of downward, top-down kind of pressure where if you bring up new stuff to your boss, he's going to say, you know what? Shut up and go do something else that's in your job description. You know?
Right.
So the culture of Westworld, it's not a healthy work culture.
Clearly.
And Cullen's in there being like, the board wants this stuff. I don't care if you couldn't sleep. I don't care if you're my lover and you couldn't sleep. Like, the board wants the situation. What the hell's going on? You're not fixing it. So there's a weird culture problem going on there. And that's going to create a level of drama, I think, that's going to be useful when it comes to characters making the kinds of rash decisions that make for good storytelling.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Ford and Teddy for a second. So Ford, I love how Ford, drops a truth bomb to Teddy, telling him, basically, you're never going to have a happy ending with Dolores. Your job is to keep her here. Like, you know, Teddy.
Yeah, I mean, the quote was, your job is not to protect Dolores. It's to keep her here, to ensure that the guests find her if they want, to best the stalwart gunslinger and have their way with this girl. So he's like, your job is to make sure she sticks around so people can, like, rape her.
Yeah. Which is really.
That's the first.
Poor Teddy.
That's the first truth bomb. And then the second truth bomb is like, you don't have a backstory, dude.
Yeah. We've been faking it all this time because we never really gave you a backstory. But here's the interesting thing. Here's a really interesting thing that ties into the whole bicameral mind thing. So Ford decides to give Teddy a backstory, right? He gives him a backstory about this guy, Wyatt, who was in Teddy's past. And what we come to learn that Teddy, when Teddy's talking about Wyatt, he says that Wyatt claimed he could hear the voice of God, and that Wyatt said that the land, in other words,
ooh, that's a nice connection,
the Westworld, did not belong to the natives, didn't belong to them. It belongs to something yet to come, to him. Speaking about Wyatt, so it feels to me like within this new narrative, Ford is cultivating a narrative for revolution within the hosts. Like, he is setting the hosts up to want to take their land back from.
Yeah, that's a really powerful suggestion that you lay out there, because you take it directly from what they're saying, and I think that's great, because it shows that, you know, when the inevitable does happen, it's a connection of these software glitches and the setting and everything that's going to culminate in, like, you know, just a shit hitting the fan in a nasty, nasty way.
But why is he doing that? Why is Ford instilling this revolution dynamic into the hosts?
I think he's cocky, first of all. He's like, and I think he also, when he took the storyline over from the Red River Adventure, when he told Sizemore to step back, he wanted to elicit a response from the visitors, the guests. He said, I want these people to recognize who they could be, right? They know who they are.
Is he talking about the guests, or is he talking about the hosts?
Right. It's a dual-natured comment. And I think what he wants to do is he wants to bring out a sort of heroism or adventure spirit in each one of the guests to give them the best possible experience. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He wants them to evolve while they're there. And I think that's helpful because he does say that line from Julius Caesar, a Shakespeare play, a second Shakespeare play. Remember, the Violent Delights quote is from Romeo and Juliet.
Sure.
This quote says, "A coward dies a thousand deaths. The valiant tastes death but once." Right? And when you look at the William character, right, the Jimmy Simpson character, he kind of comes in sort of cowardly, sort of like gingerly, kind of like, I don't know what I'm doing here.
Mm-hmm.
But mm-hmm. And you know, when you look at what happens with Dolores, she's basically dying every night. She's being raped and being killed every night, right? When these people start taking agency and fighting back, then they don't worry about this thousand death situation.
Right.
They're gonna live. And if you can bring that kind of thing out in all of your guests, what's gonna happen? They're gonna tell their friends about it, and those friends are gonna want to come. So it's kind of like, instead of having, hey, we ran around and shot a lot of stuff and we screwed some robots, it's an emotional journey. And I think that's what Ford is trying to pull off here. And I think that's pretty powerful.
Well, what's really interesting about that is you kind of see more of that Crichton connection, one of that old Westworld connection in, you know, Jurassic Park. I know we've mentioned this before, but he's really starting to become and feel more like the Hammond character, mm-hmm. right? The guy who built the park and had these grandiose ideas and grandiose things he wanted the guests to feel before things, you know, came crashing down around him.
Hubris.
Yeah, it's definitely hubris. And then he looks again. Remember, he's looking at these devices. You know, the hosts to him are strictly devices, so they will do what he tells them to mm-hmm. do. He doesn't have a mm-hmm. whole bunch of, you know, he doesn't like the idea of sentience. He's not trying to chase any kind of consciousness. He just wants them to behave properly and trick people into thinking that they're alive, right? And the question is, it almost seems like he's got something, a hidden agenda somewhere in there.
Yeah.
But it might just be this crazy hubris and this idea that, like, you're going to do what I say and it's going to be fine. When you put more backstory into these puppies, they tend to remember, and when they remember, you know, the shit hits the fan. So
let's talk about the end of Stubbs and Elsie's journey to find the stray, because I think that was pretty significant. So, you know, Stubbs and Elsie are chasing down the stray. One of the few people in his group of hosts that were allowed to carry a weapon, in this case, particular case, an axe. He's also a carver, and he's been carving these wooden toys that have these constellations carved into them, specifically the constellation of Orion.
The hunter,
exactly. And they track him down to this crevasse where he's stuck in, much like a stray cow, when a stray cow gets stuck on a ranch, you know, and they he's kind of helpless and just wandering around. So Stubbs goes down to take his head,
extract him, yeah,
to basically lop his head off, and the idea that I get from that is to take it back to the lab for study, right?
Right, because Elsie's like, dude, we don't have to do that. We can just wait till the morning. They'll send a helicopter in or whatever. We'll just get a crane and pull him up. And
right.
He's like, no, I'll just take his head right now. And it's kind of one of those things that's like foolhardy. For me, all the foreshadowing when she left the message on Bernard's phone, I'm like, oh my God, she's going to die. That's why they left the message. luckily, she stayed alive. But what was also really interesting about that for me was you know, we get a lot of realness there because a couple things happen that are very, very like tangible. You can kind of realize how things work. The first is they go to the place where the kind of little posse is sitting around the fire, the little dead rabbit or whatever. And they're sitting there and they keep on going. Their narrative loop doesn't work because there's no wood to burn the stuff. And so they've been going in this loop for a while. They should have been doing cattle ranching or something,
right,
2 days prior. So that just shows what happens when you do pull people off, when there are these like kind of little things that go wrong. And
right,
one of the reasons why Cullen is so upset, right? These things are going wrong. You know, it's not working. So that's another thing. The second thing is we learn that there are these permissions. The permissions are about who can carry a weapon. And what's interesting about that is, I mean, it makes sense, but at the same time, it's also a new thing.
Mm-hmm.
Corporate put that in. Cullen put that in recently. for a security perspective or insurance liability or for whatever reason, it's a new thing. Her putting in that control is part of the reason why those guys are sitting around there not doing anything. Back in the day, let's call it, when everyone had access to an axe or a gun, yeah, somebody else would have gone and cut the wood down and moved forward. So it's interesting to me that, again, back to the culture of Westworld, she's not taking responsibility or even acknowledging perhaps what she's done to make some of these problems occur. But another thing that kind of is real is, you know, they're out, they're walking, they get there in the middle of the day, and suddenly it's nighttime almost.
Yeah.
And the first thing I said to my wife when I was like watching this with her was, wow, where do they go to the bathroom? And then just then she's like, right, where are you going? She's like vectoring, and she goes like pops a squat. And I was just like, that's real. That never happens on TV, right? It happened in like Game of Thrones once when Arya had to use the bathroom and they caught her as a girl. But it doesn't usually happen on TV. So that little detail is like, good, someone's using the toilet,
yeah,
right? Because that needs, yeah, to happen. I don't need the paper and like all the logistics of all that stuff.
Right.
Like, how do you wipe? But I just need to acknowledge that people are human and the humans have to do this stuff. And that was
Dwayne needs the toilet functionality in his shows. That's why Dwayne probably didn't like 24, right? They never stopped to use the bathroom.
Oh my God, 16 hours of television, nobody uses the bathroom.
No verisimilitude there with toilets. So moving on from that, so this is the significant thing for me is when the stray basically leaps back to life and comes out of the crevasse, incapacitates Stubbs, jumps out of the crevasse, and he looks like he's going to picks up a rock and he looks like he's going to brain Elsie. He does something to me is fascinating. He self-sabotages. He brains himself. He crushes his own skull, and I think that he's doing this to prevent it from being studied in an autopsy.
I think you're exactly right. Exactly right.
He's covering the evidence.
And the question is he doing that of his own accord, or is there an instruction to do that?
Is there a voice in his head that's telling him to do so?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And was his strainness happening because he was called by a voice in the head? Someone was hacking into him to do that? Or like, was there sabotage going on? Or was his consciousness, you know, realized to the point where he knew that was a problematic thing? That's a very interesting thing. It's also interesting to note that we're talking about voices in the head. When Dolores does pull out that gun from the hay, it's Bernard's voice, not anybody else's voice that she's hearing. And so it's interesting to wonder whose voice is in the other people's heads, right? Is Ford's voice in someone's head? Mm-hmm. Is it all Arnold?
Whose voice is in Walter's head when he's talking about the milk?
Right. Well, we think that's Arnold because he's talking directly to Arnold. Like, he needs more milk, which is just the weirdest thing for that character to want. Like, I don't need more whiskey. I'm walking around with some milk. that was weird. But I guess we're similitude. But yeah, it was very interesting how he crushed his own skull. And the dramatic tension when he's holding the rock above Elsie and the expectation that she's going to die because she left this voicemail is foiled, which is great.
Yeah.
Got to love when you're not when you're surprised by stuff. And then he crushes his own head, and that's really gross. Right? It's really something. So that was it just leaves a new place for us to look now. There's like a whole bunch of plot that needs to be laid out.
A couple more points that I wanted to make. For myself from this episode is this episode was directed by Neil Marshall, who is a director of The Descent and Dog Soldiers, a couple of notable films, and directed two of the most engaging episodes on television in the last few years, the Game of Thrones episode Blackwater and Hannibal episode The Great Red Dragon. So a solid bit of directing effort from Neil Marshall. Also, I thought it was interesting that the co-founder's name is Arnold, because I think that is the showrunner's direct nod to the fact that when Westworld was going to be a rebooted movie before it became a series, for the longest time they had planned to have Arnold Schwarzenegger play the Man in Black, the gunslinger, essentially. Which I'm glad they didn't do, because I feel like that's a little bit too much like the Terminator, which is, you know, direct connection from Westworld to the Terminator.
Right. Also, this idea of, like, you know, Westworld with the robots and the Terminator is the robot. I mean, that's what you're saying, but I just wanted to make that, like, obvious to anyone listening. That would be a little too much.
Any other thoughts about this particular episode from either of you guys that you wanted to make note of?
I guess I did like just hopping back to that those conversations happening between Dolores and Bernard. Bernard says something very interesting. He says that evolution has basically made all of creation through one tool, the mistake. And that tool is the mistake, right?
Yeah. This is a theme throughout the show, as we're seeing, right?
So evolution's a theme throughout the show, but you know what else is a theme throughout the show? The idea of mistakes, right?
Exactly.
I mean, these characters make huge mistakes. The idea that this Stubbs guy is going to go down and cut somebody's head off when he knows that a group could come pick the guy up tomorrow, that's a mistake. Everything that Bernard's doing with Dolores might be a mistake. Ford made a mistake with the Reveries to begin with. And apparently Arnold's mistake was this bicameral mind situation. It's mistake heaped on mistake.
And will all of these mistakes add up to sentience, to the next evolution in the race being, you know, the hosts?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the confluence of these mistakes that are an issue. What really got me also was, let's go back to Stubbs and the whole head cutting off thing.
Sure.
So these hosts are meant not to hurt people. And in fact, Stubbs says there's only one line of code keeping them from hacking us to bits, right?
Yeah.
And so that was pretty, because I'm thinking Three Laws of Robotics from Isaac Asimov.
Yeah.
So when that guy, that host, he basically elbows Stubbs, which is a pretty much I'm hurting somebody thing, which they're not supposed to do. And that was really interesting to me, because they're not really supposed to do that. Also, he wakes up when he's supposed to be under, right? She turned him off, not even with a voice command. She turned him off with the iPad or whatever she's got. And that just goes to show that they really don't have control over these things at all. That's a pretty strange thing. So those things are strange. That guy elbows Stubbs, like he hurts a human being, runs up and then crushes his own head. And then this idea that he's off, but he turns back on again. That was pretty strange.
Yeah, I think for me, there was one scene that I'm still trying to, you know, completely understand, but it was when the gunslinger is kind of surrounded by the guys in costume. Do you guys
the masked call that guys scene?
The masked Wyatt's individuals
men.
And he like turns around and shoots them all in rapid form, but the bullets don't seem to hurt them, making you sort of question whether
not
or
the
not...
gunslinger. Teddy was the guy doing that.
Oh yes, Teddy.
It was Teddy. So we see these guys with their heads covered up, right? And you're right, Dustin. How could we forget? But the strange thing about that is that we've also see our new the female guest who's good with the rifle, who's very excited. You know, she, you know, she's, I don't know if she's freaked out, but he's like, you guys got to go, and she's like, okay, I'm leaving.
Yeah,
like a very practical thing. Usually the guests, you can imagine the guests being foolhardy and getting themselves in trouble. But yeah, he does, and he goes and he pops all these rounds, and we know two things. One, if you're a human being and you get shot, it's not as simple as it just not happening.
Yeah.
The man in black, he's just a tough son of a bitch. So when he gets shot, he's like, it's not really hurting me. But when William gets shot, that the new character played by Jimmy Simpson, you see the welt on him as if he got hit by a paintball or a pea gun or something. So if those people are really people, perhaps all that cloth on top of them is to help them, they're really human, to help them not have to deal with this situation of like getting stung every time you get shot. Because that guy unloaded on those people, and nothing happened. So, whether those individuals are just walking around like Marty McFly with some iron on their chest,
Or maybe they're
human,
maybe they're guests,
or maybe they're human,
maybe they're guests. What? Let me bring
this. Saying, they either could be guests, not guests. They're hosts. They're walking around with iron on their chest, like Marty McFly was.
Well, let me bring this up as a point though. If they could be guests, because, and I say that because we know from both the show and from other canon articles by the showrunners that one of the rules of Westworld is if it looks like one guest might be harmed by another guest, a host will step in and intervene to protect the guest that's in danger of being harmed. And that's exactly what Teddy did when he sent the woman away. You better get out of here.
Right. So I think all signs point to guests. I was joking about the Martin McFly thing. All signs definitely point to guests. It's just a question of what's their agenda? You know, who are these dudes running around now? with cloaks on. And are they dressed like that to kind of hide themselves from the computers? You know, like what kind of people are like, hey, I'm going to spend 40K a day to cover myself in a black hood and run around. Right. That's pretty.
Yeah.
Pretty strange. There might be a level of people in Westworld who are like, let's go and see if we can kill real people. Kind of like that old Ice Cube.
Interesting. Or interesting. Like, because this all of this is part of Ford's new narrative.
I hope maybe it is.
It's hard to say because
it's hard to say with those guys in the hood.
They're part of Wyatt's crew, weren't they? Isn't that what the backstory?
That's the assumption that the robot made. Because remember, the robots, the hosts, if they come across stuff that doesn't make sense, they fold it into their narrative.
Okay.
So he screamed and said, "Oh, this must be people from Wyatt," but it may not be. I mean, he did say that the Wyatt people are crazy.
Yeah.
And these people seem pretty damn crazy. But at the same time, there's no way for us to tell right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I didn't think Ford's vision was complete yet. I thought it was still getting put together.
Yeah, you're still marinating it a little bit.
Yeah.
I'm marinating. All right. One more point I wanted to make, the big picture point, an observation about this, about the in-park scenarios. That is a direct connection, I think, from the 1973 Westworld movie, is that in the Westworld movie, Michael Crichton said that since most of the situations in the film are cliches, they are incidents out of hundreds of old movies, that the scenes should be shot as cliches. And we've seen that in the movie. And if you've seen, this is relating to the movie now, so if you've seen the movie, you know that a lot of the scenarios that before the park goes awry and the Yul Brynner gunslinger character starts killing everybody, the scenarios that they present that are in park scenarios are very cliche. And I feel like that's been carried over into this series as well. The encounters that you have, and we've seen it in the first episode, in the original, we saw the encounter with the bartender, with the prostitutes, bank robberies. They're very stilted sort of cliche scenarios, and they're
things that individuals who just live in our culture would be relatively familiar with how it's supposed to go.
Exactly. They're not based on Old West history. They're based on the mythos of the Old West as we've seen in cinema and popular culture. And I think that's intentional, an intentional choice by the showrunners to make the within story narrative writers write the Westworld scenarios like they're a grandiose Old West plays, essentially.
So here's the thing. I'm gonna one up you on this.
Yeah.
I think that the difference between those grandiose narratives, like the Red River Adventure that Sizemore was trying to build, and what we see with what Ford's trying to do, is that Ford is going to attempt to move away from the Wild West, the Western film situation. Ford is going to try to do something different that's not based on cliche. And I say that because Ford tells Teddy that Teddy's backstory will be a fiction that, like all great stories, is rooted in truth.
Interesting. Interesting. I think
so. I think that what Ford's trying to do is build something that's far more subtle,
right?
And
so
far more gray,
right? So rather than scenarios that are based on this sort of mythos of the West that we've seen in popular culture, he's going to base his scenario in truth,
right? On some level of
on
truth,
some level,
you know, based on truth. It also makes sense though, because if he's been working this place for 30 years and it's been a whole bunch of cliches of, you know, throwing men down bars and having shootouts at high noon, he wants something different. He wants something that inspires him. He wants a scenario that he'd be interested in working in. Because to him, so much of this is rote, right?
Right, right, right.
So that's a thing that I think works with his character. But yeah, I really think that quote from Ford foreshadows what we're going to see when it comes to a different type of story, a darkening of Westworld, so to speak.
Before we get into the next segment here, I just wanted one more thing. At some point in the future, I want to talk about character names on this show. But we're just going to hold that conversation for a while. But in the meantime, let me just say that within this episode, Dr. Ford says, when the legend becomes fact, print the legend. That is a direct quote from the movie The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, which is a famous Western directed by John Ford. And I think that that's an obvious nod from the showrunners to that shows their influences, which is, again, American cinema references when they're talking about sort of the grand scheme of how Westworld lays out its scenarios. All right, so that brings us to Ephemera, our reading list. So first off, there is an article that directly relates to this episode about the bicameral mind. And it's what the bicameral mind theory means to Westworld. It's from Thrillist.com, from Matt Patches. He does dive down into the origins of consciousness in the breakdown of the bicameral mind, the preeminent paper on the bicameral mind from Princeton lecturer Julian Jaynes. So it's worth
a read. He's also not afraid to talk about how controversial it is.
Absolutely worth a read. Within the last week, there was a New York Comic Con cast interview, cast and crew interview on Facebook Live about Westworld. And within that interview, showrunners Lisa Joy and Jonathan Nolan discussed their influences. And amongst their influences were Her, 2013 movie, which we've talked about briefly before. Which asks the consciousness question, but in this particular case, the AI suffers from a lack of body. Another major influence, and I kind of innately knew this, but when Lisa Joy mentioned it, like immediately it snapped into clear focus. Oh yeah, that's exactly right. She talked about Never Let Me Go by Kazuo Ishiguro and the film adaptation that they made in 2010 of this. And that is, without getting into any spoilers about that book or movie, because I think it's one that people should absolutely see. She said that it's humanity as seen through the eyes of an underclass, people who are used by society and denied their own humanity. And that's exactly what's going on with the hosts in Westworld. Also, Tosin, there was another article that directly relates to this episode tonight.
Yeah, there's an article on how Westworld's laboratory 3D prints robots and realism. So it's a pretty interesting article on inverse.com that discusses around the designs of the hosts and the advanced lab that make it.
Yeah, they talk to the production designers and the production designer and the head of the VFX team on Westworld, and they talked about basically their design influences for creating the manufacturing lab, and also how they decided to make the basically an office for God, which is Dr. Ford's office, which we see for the first time in tonight's episode. So it's,
yeah, it's pretty steampunky. It's like a steampunky God office. It's also cool because they mentioned that, like, in Westworld, one of the challenges is if they just kind of made it all take place in Westworld, you'd never think about this stuff, but because it's all about the underpinnings of how this stuff happens, they have to really get into these nitty-gritty details, you know, whether it's the narrative loops or it's, you know, the way in which they actually build these and construct these devices that seem to be like people. So that's pretty powerful. I'm not usually a behind-the-scenes guy, but I definitely appreciated this one.
Yeah, there's some really fascinating articles in conjunction with the tech websites about Westworld. It's really great. It's really in-depth. We'll talk about some more on future episodes as well. Tosin, there was another movie link that you wanted to talk about in relation to this episode.
Yeah, there's a film that came out in 2014 called Edge of Tomorrow, starring Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt. And it really conveys that sort of video game-esque of repeating of Tom Cruise, you know, continually comes back and replays the same day over and over again. This movie used to be called Live, Die, Repeat, and he, you know, dies, learns how to avoid death the next time it repeats. So this is kind of the things that you see and hear a lot of in this episode, specifically with Dolores. Mm-hmm. And
leveling
up flashbacks. Yeah, exactly.
All right. So last but not least, we have a listener email that we wanted to read about. And Dwayne, why don't you take that?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, we get your mail. We email response if that's necessary. Some of them kind of like bubble up to the top as super poignant points, and so we want to bring those out. We got this message from a female listener. We're not going to say her name because we didn't get permission to, but if you'd like us to read your name on the show in the future, include it in where you're writing from, and we'll definitely give you a shout out. But basically, she writes that, you know, in some of the things we've spoken about, we haven't touched on this idea of cognitive dissonance, which is this idea of incompatible beliefs that create an emotional discomfort, right? This is the kind of idea that, like, the William character, played by Jimmy Simpson, he seems to have the most of. He gets to this place and he recognizes that, yes, if you want, you can have sex with a robot. If you want, you can shoot this person. But he feels like that, while he knows it's perfectly okay to do it, it's inconsistent with the way he lives his life, and so he's not able to just kind of hop in there, right? And so his friend and the man in black, she writes, don't feel this dissonance. They're told that they can rape and pillage, and they feel entitled to do so, believe it's their right, so they go ahead. Any dissonance they might experience because of society's rules or the realistic appearance of the droids is resolved by deciding society's rules don't apply to them, don't apply here, or the droids aren't real, so they're not entitled to the same protections as human. Westworld works because they provide guests with these scripts to resolve the dissonance. So those are her words. And I thought it was a really salient, poignant way to express this idea that there are people there that don't have this burden of morality, we've called it, but really cognitive dissonance is what she's talking about. This idea that you can go to a place and kind of run amok, and you're happy to do so because you know none of it is real. You're able to kind of rationalize in your mind that you can do these things, whereas a person who's been socialized properly will probably go in there and have trouble, like the William character has trouble, with doing some of these acts that we typically find abhorrent, like murdering and raping. Exactly. Or, you know, in some cases, people don't like prostitution either. So it was a poignant thing. Thanks for the email. Keep on sending them. And again, we'll write you back, or we'll bring them up on the show. And if you send us a voice memo with your iPhone or your Android, you can just email that to our HBO Westworld podcast at gmail.com, and we will happily play it if the audio quality is good enough.
All right, before we sign off here, let's just talk briefly about the scenes from the weeks to come, the new scenes that they showed us. So within the previews for the next episodes, a couple of things really stood out for me. We see Bernard instructing Dolores to find the center of a maze. He says, I'm going to give you this game, and it's a maze, and if you find the center of the maze, you might be able to free yourself. So now
which acknowledges that the maze is a real thing and not just something that the man in black is like crazy about, right?
Right, right. So this is a top level, something that has been crafted by the techs. We know that now, at least based on this scene, and it's not just something that was maybe hidden by one person, by Arnold. This is a top level quest that the man in black is going after. And also another thing that I thought was interesting is towards the end of that that preview clip, we see some sort of massive excavation going on in the real world, in the world of Delos. These huge earth movers carving out parts of the landscape. We're not entirely sure what's going on, but we've never seen anything like that in this show so far.
And Delos is the place where Westworld is. So we imagine it's some sort of island, like in Jurassic Park, or some sort of cut-off space, and that's where they built Westworld.
All right, so that does it for the end of our podcast, with the exception of going around the room here. I'm going to start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find your work online when you're not here talking about Westworld?
You can find me on Twitter. I'm Dwayne D. That's D-W-A-Y-N-E-D. You can check out some of the stuff we've been writing about Westworld on Geeks of Doom, whether it's about the original Westworld movie and how it dovetails into this, or about some of the technology of Westworld and what that means, and some of the influences of Westworld. You know, some of the things that you can see directly have played into the way that they present the story here. You can also check me out on the Drill Down with you guys. Tosin, what about you? Where can we find you?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321 and other ramblings, also at the Drill Down, as well as Geeks of Doom. What about yourself, Andy? Where can we find you?
You can find me at MrBabyMan.com or just do a Google search for Andrew Sarcini or Mr. Baby Man, and that you'll find all of my social media links throughout the week. Also, you can find me along with these two fine gentlemen on The Drill Down, which you can find at thedrilldown.com, or go to geeksofdoom.com, and you can find all of the Geeks of Doom podcast network shows in the right-hand sidebar, including The Drill Down and Violent Delights. All right, that's going to do it for us for Violent Delights for this week. We're going to keep watching Westworld, so join us next week for the next episode, and we'll see you next week.
You guys know we're triggering all the hosts right now by just repeating our name of our podcast.
We don't say the full phrase, so.
Whatever helps you sleep at night, Andy.